the cyber criminals, what can they learn from this and reuse some of these techniques? Again, I keep repeating, what can be reused to maybe go after 10, 20, $30 million ransomware or something, whatever that could be.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast, Sunil and Mario. Great to see you guys.
Great to see you.
Hopefully, you haven't you're not stuck abroad. It looks like you're actually both at home.
Yeah. Although I was on a cruise recently, a cybersecurity cruise.
Oh, you
it was
did that?
Pretty cool. Yes. Yeah. Was it was actually cool? Pretty. It was fantastic. I was really skeptical as to whether it would whether the organizers could pull it off, but it was fantastic. It was. We had some really great people come, but I was just shocked that companies sent their employees to this event. Paid, right? It's like a paid vacation, effectively. But anyway, that's it. It was a fantastic event.
I wonder if those companies knew the details, though. I wonder if the word
"oh yeah," they definitely did.
The expense report.
Wow.
I don't know how they. Well, it was be flagged as a conference, right? That's exactly
that's
what
I'm
it was.
Saying. What's in is the expense report definitely says conference, but does it have the word cruise on it or not? I wonder. Probably 50-50.
It would say Royal Caribbean.
Ooh. Yeah. No, there had to be some middleman that says some kind of innocuous name, I'm sure.
Possibly.
You know what? I had heard about that thing over the years. Is there only one, and the one you went to is the one that's been going on for years and all that?
No. This was the first one. So cruisecon.com. And it was the first inaugural event, and I think the plans are for them to have it again in the West Coast. So this one was on the East Coast. The next one's going to be in the West Coast, and then one in Europe coming up.
Wait a minute. Is this thing like multiple days or just a one day thingy?
It's a multiple day event. So you have a sailing, you have the cruising period when you actually are having the conference, then you're at port. And when you're at port, that's kind of like your off day. And then when you go cruising again, it's when you have the conference.
So the way that normal conferences work, right, you have different rules for vendors and participants, different rates. And then I bet a lot of us would go to cons and not go, like, you know what I mean? Like, you do adjacent things or catch, especially like at RSA when it's in San Francisco and you have a lot of business to do there anyway, and everybody's in town, you just meet up. You can't do that. Like, it's not like you're on the dinghy next to the cruise ship because you're just doing LobbyCon or something. Did you as a vendor have to pay? And what were you, like, not allowed to certain parts of the boat at certain times?
No, so it's so first of all, it's folks. That's different. But I think this was different for a number of reasons, because this was like the best of LobbyCon with the actual conference. The rest of the time was LobbyCon, if you think about it. Or
But you had to pay to get on. Like, everybody there had to pay. You know what I mean? There
weren't
grifters.
Yes. That's right.
There weren't drifters, but no grifters.
You'd be thrown overboard, I guess, if you were a drifter. Grifter.
Okay. Well, that's cool. I mean, I'm glad that's a thumbs up. It sounds like a completely, sincere your thumbs up for that thing. I'll keep my eye on it. And especially, in Europe, if it turns into a river cruise or something. Now we're talking. Yeah.
I think it's going to be on the Mediterranean, so not quite a river cruise.
Okay. Okay, but cool ports of call, that's for sure. Well, good. Well, let's jump right into it. Tumultuous time to be a podcaster about just about anything these days with geopolitics, right? Where we're recording on the heels of the Zelensky Trump spat in the White House and so on. One of the things that's making the headlines is about CISA when it comes to cuts and DOGE cuts and all of that. Unlimited material, but and give us feedback if people think we should do differently, but we're generally just trying to stick to things that are cyber related here in the interest of time. So CISA, before we get into the specifics on it, do you guys feel like there was room for CISA to have cuts?
Well, I think the one thing that I was definitely anticipating would get cut would be anything tied to election security, just because of how it was perceived by election security and information disinformation, and the focus that CISA had on those two areas. So, given this new administration, I absolutely expected those particular components to get cut, just because that would have been seen as hostile to this administration. But I think some of the other things that got cut, I was a little bit surprised by, maybe some things I wasn't so surprised by, but again, the things that were the that some people would argue was not core to CISA's mission getting cut. Yeah, I can see that happening. I do think those two topics, though, still need a home somewhere, if not CISA.
Okay.
So wait, Sunil, there were some things that CISA was covering that wasn't part of their charter? Is that? I wasn't as informed.
It's not that it wasn't part of his charter, but like misinformation, disinformation, and combating that, is that part of CISA's charter or is that part of some other? Is that core to CISA's charter? That's really the question.
I see.
And you can imagine how the concerns around misinformation and disinformation was seemingly directed more towards one political party than the other, and hence why it would suffer one of the first cuts.
Yeah, I mean, to call out specifically, and if I'm wrong, it's simply out of memory and not out of any kind of agenda here. But as I recall it, and I think it was in the previous election, the CISA had some reports saying there's disinformation campaigns targeting the Democratic platform and campaigns, and there was some pushback saying this is biased, CISA's being weaponized and used, and so that plays right into where Sunil was saying it's not surprising, and it kind of got vilified as another deep state, you tool of the deep state type thing, and you know, so separately from all the other Doge cuts, it's unsurprising that it would have some targeting / retaliation directed at it.
So basically, if my face is sitting in your fist, it's my fault. Is that what we're saying?
You moved your face.
I knew I could draw that out of you, Mario. I mean, they were. I mean, to the average person, the average layperson, they never heard of CISA. So anything that you hear about in government, like, well, what's that? It sounds kind of weird. And when the time you hear about it is because it's releasing information you don't like, then put that together, you got a recipe for vilification. And that's what happened. So I looked at, you know, some of the reporting on this. What I didn't see yet is that the whole damn thing is getting cut or anything like that. I did see some bullet points of specific things. The one that caught my eye as recognizable and interesting was CIRCEA. So, right, this is a quick recap. It's not a regulator, CISA or DHS for that matter, CISA being a department of DHS. Not a regulator, generally does not promulgate regulation. Sectors have sector-specific regulators usually. That said, CIRCEA was the one place that wasn't necessarily true. It was a regulation, and it was about critical infrastructure having to report incidents and duplication to a lot of those sector-specific regulators. So I'm not surprised that there's been some government relations departments of companies that would have been impacted by this saying, hey, anytime there's an opening, ask to get CIRCEA killed. And I guess they were at the right dinners or whatever. Do you think that that's bad for the industry for CIRCEA to go away? CIRCEA?
The notion of mandatory reporting versus voluntary reporting, it's been a constant debate about what's the right way to approach this. Mm-hmm. And we've done voluntary reporting, or, you know, there's always been a mechanism for voluntary reporting. The question is, has it been effective to the degree that we need it? And of course, I think the biggest concern has always been like, what's the blowback if we report it, right? What liabilities might we incur? Well, if there is a mandatory reporting mechanism, then I think at the end of the day, we need some sort of safe harbor in those situations. And so I don't know if I ever felt that this mechanism that was put forth gave us that confidence of safe harbor. And maybe that's one of the reasons why it needs to be rethought, in my view, and restructured to think about what is it that we really need from industry to provide the insights that we need to be able to know how to advance our mission forward and to be better in cybersecurity. At this point in time, I don't know what the administration has in mind for revisiting this particular thing or to enable that sort of mechanism, information sharing to happen. But I would also say, given that we shouldn't anticipate any more attacks from the Russians, maybe knowing what ransomware payouts are happening will be a moot issue, right?
From the Russians, Sunil, but I mean, we still have North Korea, we still have, is it just Russia or is it, they're including everybody else?
I was kidding, but that said, yes, there are certainly many other ransomware actors out there, and knowing having insights on who's getting hit is helpful. From a collective standpoint, mm-hmm. the question is really, you know, what's the mechanism for capturing that? I would argue one mechanism is going to be insurance providers. So maybe insurance providers provides a way to make it one level obfuscated from the actual victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I think it's worth noting that when we're talking about critical infrastructure, right? And I think we said this in a few episodes that we were talking about with a capital C, proper noun, designated critical infrastructure, which is a very small number of firms that would have been bound by this, versus the lowercase, I think this is really critical. Like that's not what we were talking about falling under this requirement. And I think the reason why I would say that this was a direct result of Colonial Pipeline, meaning, and in particular, critical infrastructure whose primary regulator was not pushing cyber-related regs very hard. Because all the economic infrastructure and arguably maybe, you know, healthcare or others have a ton of regs floating around already. But the TSA, which was the Colonial Pipeline regulator, in hindsight, people felt like they didn't have a lot. So CRC would just be kind of an equal playing field. If you're critical infrastructure, in addition to whatever regs you have, we're going to at least set this bar. Maybe TSA stepped up. Maybe everybody reviewed and we don't really need it anymore. Not sure.
You know, I've always felt, and maybe this is just confirmation bias, but I always felt like sharing information and learning from, it's not like I'm there looking for news about what my fellow colleagues' security mistakes were done, but learning from my errors, from the industry. I thought that was always being useful. Not that this would tell you what mistakes were done, but at least getting an idea of ransomware payouts and what are these ransomwares and who are they targeting? What operating systems are targeting? Not agencies, not infrastructure. We're not in the infrastructure business. PTPs. I get it. We're not critical. Yeah, but exactly. Understanding that. I thought that was really, I thought we would benefit from that. Yeah. And to Sunil's point, here, hopefully, maybe the insurance industries will play a bigger role. Although I feel like they're also getting hit with all the recent disasters that have happened in the year. So, I mean, they're really, insurance companies, as much as I think we're all experiencing that, they're losing a lot of money and they're going to begin to make cuts. And I don't know if they're going to have the people to be able to report on some of this stuff for the commercial space rather than government space.
You know, I think this brings up a really interesting, relevant point. So in general, you have like public and private sectors, entities that are capable of doing things that are kind of whole of nation mission. And I feel like the public sector is good to step in when there isn't a natural motivation for the private sector to get things done. I deal with this more commonly in research, right? I'm a professor of the practice at Georgia Tech, research university, state-sponsored research university. And you know, when I think of research, I think of like in biology and even in civil E and chemicals and on, I can think of a lot of stuff that gets done in that research university that thank God it gets done because I don't think the private sector would be directly motivated to do the research. But when it comes to cyber, and I'm in the School of Cybersecurity and Privacy, which is largely research-based, it's really interesting to me because I think we have a lot of research going on in the private sector, unlike anything else. You know, you always get headlines if you're a security startup by releasing the latest security research. That's the number one marketing avenue. Mm. Mm. So it's almost like, you know, I'll see projects come out that are research, that are academic related, and it's like, 3 years ago, so-and-so thought that was interesting, and they spent $6 million and got a report out in 2 weeks. Like, it's a massively different delta. So all that to say, like, the public sector, whether it's academia or whether it's CISA in this case, when it comes to cyber, maybe the private sector has some perverse or not motivations, but has been keeping up a little better. And maybe it's okay if the private market handles this.
Well, let me offer. Let me offer some ways to think about this type of reporting. So we call this cybersecurity reporting, but let me actually drop the word cyber for a moment and just call it security reporting. In fact, let's talk about security breaches. And reporting security breaches, not cybersecurity breaches, just security breaches. Okay. Do we report to the government when a a physical breach occurs inside of our building?
No,
not really.
Yeah.
Right. That's moreover, security concerns usually are not publicly reported because that signals something to the broader public as well as to other threat actors about the nature of how susceptible you might be to a security breach. Yeah. That's different than, let's say, a safety issue. Okay, a safety issue, you want to communicate as broadly as possible because you want other people to avoid a safety concern, a similar safety concern. So this is why like airplane safety is such a like reported so broadly and shared so broadly. It's also why even nuclear safety concerns are shared amongst adversaries as well, because we don't want them, we definitely don't want them to have a nuclear safety issue just as much as we don't want to have one ourselves. Okay, but none of us share nuclear security breaches. Okay? So the question, I think the essence of what is it that we're actually reporting and why, what's the intent? This is about security breaches, let's be clear, right? We're talking security breaches, and we're not talking about safety breaches. But if we are, let's, for the sake of argument, say this is meant to look more safety-oriented. Okay? This is meant to be safety-oriented so that, hey, everyone, there is a widespread safety concern that's happening here, and we want to share with you what the lesson learned was from this safety incident so that you don't see the same thing happen to yourself. Okay, if there's a way to frame this type of incident reporting so that it is framed and a certain type of best practice, whatever else it might be, then I think that's a good reporting outcome. And I thought, in some respects, that's what the Cyber Safety Review Board was supposed to do.
So okay. Wait, are you saying that there's really, I mean, that's a really interesting position you're bringing up. You're saying, are we questioning the efficacy of these efforts from CISA, or in this case, CERSIA, I'm sorry. I mean, when we're really breaking it down, is it helping or not? And I'm hearing something here that may not be helping. Am I taking it wrong?
No, so it's more about the intent. There is a need for us to, we should report security breaches to the law enforcement, right? Law enforcement, when we have a physical security breach, we call law enforcement and say, hey, we have a concern, you know, whatever. And if there's sufficient number of these, then law enforcement handles them appropriately to see a pattern emerge. But these aren't things that are shared broadly. Just saying, you know, that it's these security breaches are not shared broadly because they deal with law enforcement, they deal with things that are highly sensitive. And so if the and that is useful content to have somewhere, but it's not meant for it's not meant for public dissemination. It's meant for, again, a whole different purpose. If the goal of the cyber incident reporting is, I think you were saying earlier, if it's for best practices, then I don't think we should call it a security incident. We should talk about it in terms of how do you talk about the best practice from a safety level.
Lessons learned.
Whatever else it might be.
Yeah.
Which, again, fundamentally is what the CSRB was supposed to do. They, of course, picked, in some cases, they picked specific companies to call out, but I think the general pattern the pattern of activity that resulted in the failure is probably what's more interesting for the broader audience, because we're not, none of, you know, there's only one Microsoft, but we can avoid the anti-patterns that maybe they ran into.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of cuts and you know, thoughts about that, the other breaking headlines had to do with Russia and the intelligence community and monitoring, and in particular, targeted operations and offensive operations. And there's it's not an official press release, so it's not fully corroborated yet, but there's a report that Cyber Command was asked to halt offensive cyber operations against Russia. You know, my thoughts are anything like that. I mean, even when offensive operations are initiated, it's often around negotiation pressure, you know, geopolitics in general. Is this concerning to you guys immediately? Does it, or you know, I'll take a contrarian point of view. Does it say maybe there's a really good deal being made and someone's trying to prove that we can make things a little better? What's going on?
Well, I would like to see. So if there's a significant drop in Russian-based ransomware attacks, then I can see why we don't necessarily need to do some of these offensive cyber operations against Russia. In fact, so part of what started this was back in, I think, 2022, we started this thing called the Hunt Forward. And the Hunt Forward was really an attempt to conduct, well, it's a mix of words, but bottom line is that it's to conduct defensive operations forward. How do we defend ourselves by acting, by being very proactive against Russian actors and so on and so forth? So, I don't know the specifics of which programs were shut down, but my guess is it's that particular program that was told to stand down. And in all honesty, if Putin and Trump have some deal going on such that Russian ransomware actors are going to stop attacking us, then in some respects, this Hunt Forward isn't going to be as needed because they're not attacking us, right?
Yeah.
So I think we'll see how this plays out. Obviously, if there are still ransomware attacks against us from Russia and we shut down this operation, then we're going to have a lot of people having to do ransomware payouts and not having many other options because of that.
Yeah, I assumed that these intelligence operations are related to just straight up warfare planning, intelligence gathering, counterintelligence, misinformation, nothing to do with the commercial sector, ransomware, etc. You bring up an interesting point, though. I've yet to hear, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, but I've yet to hear anyone politically taking up the mantle of stopping the ransomware scourge. Has that slipped into any messaging, you know, even campaigning by politicians or anything? Have you heard anybody saying either we need to do something about this or we are pledging to do something about this?
There's some proposals being put forth, and I'm part of a couple that are being put forth to the National Security Council and folks around. Well, it's actually something that you've been pushing for a while, which is, you know, do we ban ransomware payments?
Yes.
Well, if we ban ransomware payments, we need a second option. Like, I think industry needs another lever that we can pull, because otherwise we're kind of stuck, right? Mm-hmm. You take away one option, we need another option. And the other option is something similar to these offensive cyber operations. And it's not, I wouldn't go as far as calling a hack back and whatnot, but there is a, what if there's an opportunity through third parties or some other mechanism where there's sufficiently disassociated with the victim organization where there is an opportunity to go and get the key yourself, so to speak, or wipe out the what was stolen and, you know, various other operations that can be performed. Those are the things that I think this administration might be interested in because it is striking back, right? It's putting a very strong foot forward, and that's what this administration seems prone to be receptive to.
Well, you know what I'm missing off the, or I'm interpreting from these headlines is if we're going to stop doing offensive cyber operations against a potential foe, then it's safe to assume that the foe will also stop attacking us. And so,
right.
You know, that, I mean, that's your point, Sunil. But, this brings me back to, you know, Casablanca. And you know, guys are gambling, and the guy who's supposed to be the police chief is like, "What? There's gambling going on here." And somebody offers him, you know, "Here's your winnings for the day, sir." And so with Russia, it's not like they are always directly involved in some of these ransomwares. They have other affiliates who are very well connected to the Russian government, but they can still say, "Oh, that's not us. That's an affiliate. That's a total, oh, we'll go after them. Don't worry about it." So to me, it feels like, well, is Russia going to play nice?
The easiest representation of that is going to be, hey, we have several people who have been wanted for crimes against, for these ransomware attacks. Please turn them over, extradite them. That's when it becomes real.
Yeah, I mean, back to what I was saying, though, like, I think the three of us in the circles we run in, which are generally Slack channels, everyone sees ransomware as a scourge and something that if there's some collective way we can improve the situation, it would be great. I'm not sure that's true outside of cyber circles. Like, I mean, people are worried about, what, chemtrails and like Pizzagate and like what are the populist calls to action that people are elected on? I've never heard anyone say we're going to help with the ransomware scourge or we're not going to help with it or no, I refuse to do it. Like, yeah, I haven't heard it ever come up in a town hall, in a Q&A, in a, anything. I don't know there's any political value to helping with ransomware. Am I wrong? Is this something that's going on in some forum I'm not in?
Well, until your gas or your beer gets affected, no.
Yeah, right. I mean, okay, so for 2 weeks during the Colonial Pipeline, then it carried some political value. But right
hey,
now,
I couldn't register my car up in that Florida. Remember that ransomware that attacked DMV in Florida? I couldn't register my vehicle for 2 weeks. Maybe I wasn't able to get tickets either. Maybe it's a wash. Go for it.
Yeah.
But it is. That's a really interesting stuff. No, the public is not up in arms complaining about ransomware. You hear all these stories about grandma and grandpa getting their savings, life savings stolen from some sort of ransomware. Mm-hmm. And then you would think that these grandma and grandpa vote, if we know anything about age groups, who tends to vote more, folks of certain age groups tend to vote more. So if they're the ones really being targeted, you would hear a lot of commotion there. Yeah. It is a good question, though. If ransomware is such a big deal, is it just outside of cybersecurity?
Or scams in general. I haven't seen anybody saying, let's go to the extreme, right? How about junk calls? How about those text messages that say, hey, I just got one that said, you want to come over to my house and try some Asian food? That was the one I got a couple days ago out of the blue. I don't know what's supposed to be baked into that. But like, I never hear anyone saying, elect me and I'll let those text messages stop. Why not?
Well, the cynical part of me thinks is there's a money thing in politics, right? So there has to be some folks who are your biggest donors and
care
for your particular whatever political angle you have. I'm not pointing any fingers at anybody, but it might be that nobody's really paying the politicians money for this problem. There's not enough people out there.
I think
lobbyists.
That's a safe conclusion.
Right.
So maybe if CISA should have done any one thing, it would be just, putting forward a media campaign about awareness of these attacks, whether it's romance scams or sextortion or ransomware or any of that, like just generating some public uproar about it. Oh, well.
Well, I mean, that's the job of the FTC to some degree to let people know, but there's not much of an uproar from that either.
No, there hasn't been. Yeah. All right, let's keep on spinning the globe. Well, what's the next adversary du jour? We got North Korea, right? They pivoted, just for the listeners' edification here, they pivoted maybe 5 years ago from a sabotage threat actor to an extortion threat actor, largely because of sanctions, I'd say. So sabotage meaning North Korea, they're mad about bad-mouthing the great leader. They destroy Sony Pictures. Extortion being just trying to make payroll. And we see them not only performing extortion, but also fake employment scams and just collecting paychecks and all of that. They're definitely financially motivated now. And they hit big, right? At the end of February, a $1.5 billion hack of a crypto platform, Bybit. You guys had a chance to dig into this thing and see some of the tradecraft in there?
So at the end of the day, the tradecraft, or if I understand correctly, it comes down to a supply chain, software supply chain concern. And it was, if I recall, some JavaScript library that was manipulated, and from there the attack was executed. It points to, I think, fundamentally how we are. The approach that we're taking to software supply chain, where we continually trust that which is untrustworthy, right? How do we start with the premise of all this stuff is untrustworthy, and we only allow those things that have been demonstrated to be trustworthy? If for I don't want to use we talk about zero trust over and over again, but zero trust is not just about networks. It's also about your third party code. It's also about that concept has to be applied consistently and universally across all the things that we do, and especially for high value things that could result in the loss of $1.5 billion.
Yeah, this says a lot of different things to me, and while your points are completely accurate about third party in general, I'm really worried that this is going to get interpreted as, oh man, they didn't send them the right questionnaire. They didn't send them enough questions. Because that's a load of crap. First of all, crypto security is for real. I remember when we launched a JV in the crypto space, and we had been an investor in Coinbase, an early investor in them, the company I was with. And so I kind of flew that flag. I contacted the treasury guys who would have cut the wire and got introduced that way, went over and met the CISO at the time of Coinbase. This is many years ago. And then he introduced me to Anchor Labs, that founder, and a number of other folks over there. And so I got up to speed. I'm not saying I got proficient or by any means, but I learned a lot really fast. And in banking and all of that, we come up with these crazy Hans Gruber scenarios, but they never really manifest. So we think we defend it against them. We never find out if it was effective or not. We do some dumb protective things and have the budget to do it, and a lot of them never get tested. So whatever, including supply chain. If anybody thinks they're keeping their HVAC vendor from getting hacked, and no one's trying that. It's just bogus. But in crypto, people are trying stuff all the time. And so I don't think, it's not about TPRM or about how do you questionnaire, do they have a SOC 2. It's super tactical about you don't prep transactions on machines that aren't air-gapped, things like that. Or you have a way to offline validate transactions and make sure they match the original intention. Or you never move stuff from cold storage without some offline ceremony. It's super tactical. So supply chain management is just you don't involve JS from the internet. Forget about a third party.
Yes.
From the internet,
right?
While you're doing something like this, and there's no need. I remember when we would devise a kind of thing, as stale as it sounds, a whole operating system and image would be written offline, running from battery. You couldn't even use power because of Tempest attacks and that sort of thing. To me, the takeaways are: A, crypto is super real, where real hacks happen, and there was definitely a gap here.
Coinbase runs a top shop. They're hardcore. And I cannot agree with you more, Jerry. $1.5 billion is a big freaking number. We should all recognize that, okay? I don't think that your typical cyber criminal group might be able to gain that much money and by attacking this kind of, attacking folks who do Bitcoin. But I think that what can you learn? What can cyber criminals learn from this sort of attack to target more of us, not companies who may not have that cybersecurity level that people like Coinbase have? And I say again, my whole theme again is what can people learn from it? How can they reuse some of these attacks? You might not make the $1.4 billion, but you might make $20, $30, $40 million. And that's what we see from cyber criminals. If you look at last year, $20 million here, $50 million there. $1.5 billion is a big freaking chunk of change, man.
Yeah, if your point is that looking at this tip of spear with high motivation is a way to see the future and what might trickle down, it's a really good point. This kind of tradecraft could.
And I'm not trying to scare people, though. I'm not here to say, hey, open source and supply chain and all that critical infrastructure. But I'm just saying the cyber criminals, what can they learn from this and reuse some of these techniques? Mm-hmm. Again, I keep repeating what can be reused to maybe go after $10, $20, $30 million ransomware or something, whatever that could be.
Yeah, I agree. Because I could, going through this, I could think of what is that site's called? Built With, where you can see what third-party libraries are included, websites and all of that. And you could pretty easily tell, if you get into a payment portal or something like that, and then you know where all of your content's coming from, and you can then try poking at all that. But you know, one angle on this that not a lot of people are going to talk about that I find super interesting is, I forget the exact dates here, but you had date X when 1.5 billion moved. And it must have been about 3 calendar days or so when the incident response firm, so you know, you've both been through incidents as well. Something goes on, you got your in-house folks, you bring in a third party for either because it's a disaster or because you just want to reperform your work and validate it. Then they, you have lawyers involved in the whole thing, right? They usually privilege it all, any communications going through them because they think they're going to subpoena proof it and they just charge you a lot of legal fees. And I think that's kind of a crock in itself, but that's another episode. But in any event, you finally get the report, you hear about it in a dark cafe, dimly lit somewhere, maybe before it's on the record, God forbid, do not email me and tell anybody what happened. It takes weeks and weeks, and then even if you have reporting obligations, it's a while. The incident response firm published the detailed report of what happened in about 3 calendar days from the incident. That's not going rogue. That's not, they're unprofessional. That's someone said, can you publish that report publicly? And they said, whoa, are you crazy? No, we want you to publish it publicly. Are you sure? Are you triple sure? Will you sign this? You kind of cover me. That's awesome from a security point of view, because we got to learn from this thing in days, but that's not why they did it. Like, I think they did it because they're about to go after the company that supplied that JS, that the supply chain vendor, and sue them for as much as they possibly can. And when they do that, if this report had not been public, everything would have gotten lawyered up and it went off the public record. And they, to me, this was just them saying, before anybody stops us, get all these details right out there so it's unequivocal. You think that's true? Or is there isn't it weird, 3 days?
I think the speed is remarkable in terms of getting the details that they did so quickly out there. And to your point about bypassing the legal recommendations, I don't know. This goes back to my comment about the safety versus security. If this is a security breach, effectively, right? But if they can extract the safety elements out of it and say, here's what everyone else should be concerned about, be aware of because of the safety concerns that this could be repeated, this could repeat itself across the board, then you want to disseminate that very quickly, right? Hey, these 737 MAX, they crash into the ground because of this safety flaw. You don't want to hide that. That's not something that you want to hide. So maybe in some respects, this is a representation of that safety flaw. That you can look at it that way versus a security issue. And again, a security issue, you would lock down more tightly. A safety issue is something that you would promulgate very quickly.
No, I think if I think about what you're talking about, Jerry, I'm going to be adversarial at this point. I think that, you know, you talked about, we've all talked about this where you sign contracts. Look, if you ever sign contracts with one of your vendors and you think you're really smart for having a limited liability against this vendor, you're like, wow, I did it. And you grab yourself a cup of coffee and you're excited for you did so well. Pat yourself on the back. But we talked about this. A smaller company, it's just going to go like bankrupt. They're just going to say, we're done. We're closed shop. Right. So I think this might be an example of like, it wasn't like they were going to sue this other company. It was just basically covering themselves. I think anybody who would, if they were, you know, a smaller firm involved in this thing where they became the supply chain conduit, they're just going to go out of business.
Yeah, well, that could happen.
Well, the other consideration is that my understanding is that those who had money at Bybit are going to be made whole, right? They're not going to lose their money. But if they did, you can imagine lawsuits up the wazoo as well. So we'll see. I mean, we'll see if they actually do go belly up or not. I mean, there's a lot of companies in the crypto graveyard that for whom people didn't get their money back. So we'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, that's right. And we'll see. I mean, of course, you know, they're suing for insurance and kicking everything they possibly can. But you're right, Mari. I mean, the possible, like, somebody's completely complicit and is willing to just fork it all over relative to the loss here is a different order of magnitude.
Yeah,
I'm not going to get that out. So, man, it's a big one. But yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm right and it's strategic to get this thing out there right away, I guess it's good to see that people can at least make aggressive decisions quickly. I guess with $1.5 billion out the door, you get motivated fast. All kinds of heroics take place. Yeah, just to get through the legal paperwork of green lighting this thing. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to me. So speaking of incidents and like how these entities are responding to it, there was an article out in CSOonline.com about how CISOs can rebuild trust after a security incident. And then when I read that, I kind of immediately translated my mind to like how companies can rebuild trust, and not just after, but during a security incident, because there were some quotes in there from companies that have done a pretty good job, I'd say, responding and not. How do you guys feel about this? And like, what do people have to do? And is this a real thing? Do companies really have to rebuild trust, or does nobody really care? And the stock prices always jump back.
Oh, it seems like stock prices do jump back, but there's an interesting dynamic that happens here that is worth understanding more deeply. And this comes from a book that I read called "Who Can You Trust?" by Rachel Botsman. She talks about the difference between trust and transparency. So when we have a security incident, typically what the community has seen as a really good response is to actually be very transparent about the incident. And effectively, the Bybit is an example of a great deal of transparency very quickly to share what happened. What Rachel Botsman talks about is that trust and transparency are actually not the same thing. In fact, when you... if you have full transparency, there is no need for trust. Okay? If you have full transparency, there's nothing left to trust, meaning you don't need to trust that which everything transparent, for which you have transparency. It's only when you don't have full transparency that you actually need to trust. And the question is, what are you anchoring your trust in when you don't have that full transparency? Okay, so now let's go back to a security incident. You have a security incident, and the customers that you're working with don't have full transparency into what you're doing, and TPRM it gives you a very small slice of that, you know, it gives you that transparency, but not really sufficient to really overcome that trust. So you have a breach, you want to restore trust. Well, it's not that trust that it's not really that you're restoring trust as much as that which you were not transparent about earlier, you now are being forced to be transparent. And thus, you share more about what actually happened, more about your security program, whatever else it might be. Our action in restoring, quote, trust after a security incident is not really about, again, restoring trust as much as giving more transparency to the trust that you thought you had in me, that which you don't have anymore, and now I'm going to give you that transparency after the fact.
Yeah, I think that. I see your point. I think it's a little bit more basic for me. I think about if we all have, you know, the cybersecurity space, believe it or not, is a tight community, and if we end up, I don't want to say hiding, but not sharing information in a due amount of time, in a timely basis, you're affecting other peers, your colleagues, and those colleagues are not going to want to, they're going to start kind of having doubts about who you are as a colleague. And I think that's really important. I'm not saying that we're this perfect group cybersecurity folks, professionals, but I think a lot of it is this whole trust but verify concept. And when you kind of cross one of us and you hide things or you don't expose things or share things on a timely basis, I think you lose trust with your community. And I think it's hard to do business again in that space. And let me, I think what ends up happening most of the time is it's the fog of war. Most of the time, we don't know what's happening in the security incident. We've heard about it. Maybe somebody told us from the outside. Maybe our systems are telling us. But then you got to do the investigation and trying to figure out all of this. And a lot of it is trying to figure out what has happened. Is this real or not? That takes time. And I think that's where the challenges happen. So I would think most people are not trying to withhold information unnecessarily.
Yeah, you know, I think there's another element of it, though, that we're dodging here. And that's that it's easy to be transparent when you have a good story. You know, so like Cloudflare, CISO Grant Bazorkas, man, I hope I pronounced that right in real time. A good guy, I know him. And he had a comment in here, but Cloudflare is I think, very well known for what we call transparency. Anyway, we went back to, I remember, you know, Matthew Prince in particular, the founder, outlining, and it wasn't necessarily security incidents, but operational incidents too. Like Cloudflare is known for, oh, we had a 4-millisecond blip, and the founder's writing 3 pages of exactly why the container deployment didn't go the way it was planned and what they've learned from this, and they've fixed it all. I think what he did was totally perfect. And you only have the luxury of doing that if you've got your act together well in advance. And at that point, it becomes a marketing machine, right? I love Cloudflare because of all their outages. Right? Those blogs make the rounds. I'm like, oh my God, no idea they did stuff so well. It's awesome. And if you put yourself in that boat, and Bybit's kind of in the middle because they're trying to say right away, look, we had our stuff together here. It was a third party. And speculating, but I'll say I've seen internal conversations where a security team is, it's not us, it's this third party. And I can imagine the brass and lawyers saying, like, really? Oh, okay, well, we need to make sure the world knows that it's not us. But as security professionals, when we're reading it, my point was, I'm not just blaming a third party. I'm immediately thinking, like, you know what the table stakes are here. You're not going to rely on internet-hosted JavaScript during transaction prep and signing and all of that, I would think. So to me, it's kind of those lawyers might then turn around and go, wait, but I thought you told me that we looked really good here. I'm hearing we don't look as good. On the other end of that spectrum, though, imagine, and maybe you guys can come up with one in real time, a actual incident where they look like absolute idiots, and it's not going to be because they were transparent, right? Those types of stories are only going to come out in the DOJ indictment or whatever it's going to be. And I don't blame them. Like, if you're completely transparent about being a buffoon, I don't know that's going to help. So the lesson isn't, like, during the incident what to do. The lesson is get your act together up front, and if you do, then you're going to be able to be transparent during the incident and engender trust.
I think if there's any advice, and I think we talked about this before, is put together a security incident that's well documented as much as you can and has a workflow and activities that will be performed. And get your lawyers, get all the different various teams that are going to be involved to accept and approve it and sign it. And I think that takes away a lot of the, I don't want to say second guessing, but or any temptation of not sharing. But I think, and now you cannot, there's no such thing as a perfect security incident. It encompasses everything. But if you can get, you know, if you build around the edges and build a good framework about what, how to react and when and how, that keeps all parties honest.
I
think it was Matt Prince who also, there was a Twitter conversation I remember a long time ago where he did mention it was, I'm forgetting the specifics, but I'm going to I may get some of the details wrong, but I think it was like an intern who made this a mistake, and someone tweeted back saying, oh, you know, then you should fire that intern, or, you know, it's clearly the intern's fault. And Matt said, no, it wasn't the intern's fault. It wasn't that person's fault. It was the fact that we didn't have the right processes in place to avoid this failure from happening to begin with. And I think that was exactly the right answer, right? And it gives us the confidence that they know how to think about these problems in a way that avoids that same mistake from happening twice. And is it okay for us to make a mistake? Absolutely. Is it okay for us to make 2 mistakes, the same mistake? I would say no. Then you should absolutely, you know, get punished for that. And if you don't have anything that, you know, works to try to correct these mistakes. So I think a lot of us can appear as a buffoon when a security incident occurs. But if it continues to happen in the same way over and over again, we absolutely should be lambasted for something like that.
Yeah, and you probably won't be transparent.
Yeah, probably not.
Hey, speaking of trust and third parties, and our requirement to mention AI at least once every episode, and that's in a complete joke, but socially it feels that way. You know, we were chatting, the three of us, earlier, and Mario, I think it was you that mentioned questions coming up about security for AI, and in particular, there's a lot of some of the cool early killer apps around generative text is basically around like sales enablement, right? Whether it's CRM or that sort of thing. And so those tools want to have access, and it makes total sense, to calendaring. They want to be able to figure out who you have meetings with coming up when, and soon they're going to want to look through your case management tools to remind you of what happened with that customer last time. It's, I mean, AI has just got to have access to the data that the manual processes succeed on. So the questions that keep coming up are, you know, security teams are pushing back. No, you can't hit yes, read all my calendar invites. No, you can't read my whole inbox. And sales and other teams are more and more going to be tempted to say, to hit yes, and more importantly, to push back and win that battle over the security teams. So what is the proper guidance, and how should people adjudicate whether or not it's okay to share info with these workforce apps?
Well, okay, so I actually was an early investor in a company where I saw what I call this business mesh, the business mesh being the connection between all these different SaaS applications and the permissions that they seem to ask from each other. And my belief at the time, my investment thesis at the time was, it's exposing this massive amount of content amongst all these different SaaS apps, and we're really just kind of trusting that these SaaS providers are going to, you know, to be conscious about not abusing that level of access behind the scenes.
Or being buffoons,
yes. Unfortunately, we're starting to now leverage more and more these agent-based systems that will also have that access, for which I would say the level of control from a thoughtful developer or a thoughtful product person at a SaaS app to, oh, gee, what this agent can do for us. And it's a bit more unbounded in that regard. The concern that I had with the business, this business mesh a couple years ago really didn't manifest into a real concern back when I first put that investment thesis forward. I think right now it's a much bigger concern just because of the rise of the AI agent.
What was the IRR on that investment?
Still to be seen.
Okay. Sorry, I everything goes back to IRR. Didn't count.
I think, for the security people out there, we're going to try to continue to fight this space, but we're going to be on the losing end. Right, the genie's out of the box. Out of the box. And so we might delay a few of these efforts, but I think the better way of looking at this is, how do we gain something out of this? What do we gain out of it? How can we use it to make a change in the company? Look, so Neil's right. A lot of these SaaS applications, these mesh of business applications, say SaaS applications or on-prem with SaaS applications and cloud or whatever you want to call that mesh, a lot of it points back to us, the companies themselves. We are giving people too much access. We, the consumers of these SaaS applications, give our employees too much access. We talk about this all the time. You don't have to be an administrator or root access or anything on some of these applications to have a lot more data access than you really do need, okay? So maybe what we should be, when we're worried about these tools having so much access, like some AI tools, really it's more of a reflection of our own programs or our own inability to secure our own environment.
Well, no, so there's the network effect that is happening here, and there's tremendous value in the network effect. I mean, the internet being obviously the biggest example of that. And so if we can connect my calendar to my email, to my sales application, to my Uber, to my whatever it is, it makes life easier, right? There's no question about that. And I think there's presumably the value currently exceeds the potential costs. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen the costs because either they haven't happened or they've happened and we just aren't aware of it. But I think the risks of the downside effect, or at least becoming more evident, will be greater as we see more AI agents emerge in the market.
Yeah, I don't predict that there's going to be some big oh, that company shared too much data with OpenAI, and now we all learned a lesson. Like, if there is some kind of incident around that, an intrusion, I think it's a very long game, and we'll never be able to tie that pain to the action, and so we won't learn from that, I think. And I just keep using the cloud service provider metaphor and wind back the clock and think in 2007 when the more ardent of us were hollering about cloud and, oh, you can't use the cloud. No, we're not going to use the cloud. We're never going to use the cloud. And the Mario of that day was saying, come on, guys, get on board. The ship's leaving. You're either on or you're not. And if we try to use that to learn, when you fast forward, nobody is kicking themselves for giving all that data to Amazon. Amazon never took all the data and did anything with it.
I don't know about Jerry.
Well, let me add the end of this and see if it's what you're talking about or not. But cloud service providers did enable us to misconfigure things like crazy and get raided. But yeah. Amazon wasn't the adversary. It was just via this new technology, it enabled new adversarial tactics. And I think that is totally true of AI, and that's where we're headed here. So,
I mean, just on that topic, though, cloud providers learn from our metadata and our behavior, and they started learning. Hey, you might be a mom and pop shop opening, setting up some application in your cloud provider, and all of a sudden they start seeing a spike. They, being the cloud provider, sees the spike in traffic into that particular account deployment. And they start analyzing, maybe it's Elasticsearch. Wow, I've never heard of this. What's going on here? And so, but the cloud providers do that. They will do that. They will learn from behaviors that are happening to determine whether that's a good business to get in or not. I mean, that's the facts, folks, right?
Yeah, that's business. I think every CEO who paid into that model is fine with it. I mean, it feels icky to us, but I mean,
right.
Nike pays the bills. I don't think anybody's regretting that.
Hmm. Yeah, I think at the end of the day, the provider has a lot of visibility into, to your point, what's popular, what's being used. Whether it's for TV shows or, whatever it is, there's a similar sort of perspective that they can get to say, well, we should go create our own version of that. I think, again, that's fundamentally different than what I think we're going to see with respect to this type of access that we're giving. Not to the CSP, but to see across multiple CSPs, and that just steadily increases our attack surface beyond what I think we currently can envision today.
But my meta message that I want to continue to argue on this point is: if you're the security team on the other side, and there you got your marketing team telling you want to use this AI vendor, don't fight it. Get on the bus, but get something out of it. Say, if you're going to do this, we need to go do this. I need you to harden this. Your practice needs to change. That's what you do. Yeah.
Such good advice. I hope people pay attention to that one, without a doubt. Get a career coach right here. CISO career coach. Hey, and by the way, I should note on the security for AI topic, there was a headline that came out. I know I got it pinged to me by a customer, and the title, it actually said Disney engineer's career destroyed after downloading malicious AI tool, which is immediately, purposely, intentionally interpreted as it was an AI intelligent attack and that sort of thing. What we're talking about here is Disney engineer downloaded something off the internet, double clicked it and hit okay 10 times. That's been around for a long time. It had nothing to do with AI.
Yeah.
It was malware backdoor, classic, right? So while everybody can't wait for the big lesson learned about using AI, this isn't it, and it might not happen immediately. All right, so taking us home here, lighter topic. RSA is coming up from every year. Anybody in the security world sees a lot of buzz, are you going to be at RSA? Can you go to a dinner with us? All that kind of stuff. And every year, people recoil at that and everything in between. I feel like so far my reading the tea leaves is that it's going to be a pretty successful, big, popular RSA. I feel like there's a lot of people who are able to attend this year and looking forward to it. So the thing that comes up at this point in particular, a few months out, is how do you plan your calendar? So you guys have been around the block here. Do you have any hacks? How do you strategize that?
It's an exhausting week. And it's exhausting. But to me, it's always been highly productive. It's highly productive because we're compressing really several months of meetings into one week. And part of the reason why this is happening is because I think we in the technology space, when I was buying technologies for Bank of America, or at this point now trying to convince others to buy the technologies that we're building, there's a lot of complexity in the decisions that we have to make here. And there's a lot of, oh my goodness, overload with information that we see out in the market. And so the ability to, the challenge of RSA is really, you have all this information overload. How do you distill it in a way that you can easily process it, so that you can leave with good decisions at the end of that whole week? And one of the things that I think really adds that makes this week a useful week for a lot of us is when I was at Bank of America, we came with several stakeholders that were part of Bank of America, and we could come to consensus much faster by being together in the same place. And that's one of the major drivers of decision complexity. You just have all these stakeholders that you need to coordinate across different parts of the business, and we can do that really quickly together. It's sort of like an offsite, and that accelerates that decision-making process. Anyway, but again, it's an exhausting week. I tell people this is my third dinner of the evening, and I have a fourth one that I have to go attend to. And so anyway, but each of these events are really to help bring people together, whether as a customer where I'm the customer, or as a vendor where you're trying to get the right people in the room at the same time so that they can make a decision faster.
Yeah. I really agree what you said about the offsite stuff. I remember we were out there once, and I had my direct management team with me, and we had a candidate to head up application security that was in the Bay Area. And so we were going to be, flying him over at some point or whatever. But instead we said, hey, during RSA, can you come over and meet us outside Moscone and sit down with six people?
Yeah.
He's a BISO at ICE today, Channing House, and he was phenomenal, and it worked out great. Super intimidating. I loved it. We just put him through the ringer. But it is. I think it's worth bringing the team out. I think it's worth scheduling two or three things with the team while people are out there. Otherwise, people don't even see each other. But regroup. What'd you do yesterday? What'd you hear? What was good? That kind of stuff. Really valuable. For me, I always block off Tuesday and Wednesday. Massive bike rides. It's no better cycling in the world than Marin County, right? Mario, I'm counting on you. I'm counting on you. I'm telling you right now so that you can defend yourself to anybody who says that they have something to say. I am sorry. You heard Jerry. I'm committed. I drugged Sunil out on one of these bike rides one year. This is real, right? But I also, like anything that's after pretty much dark, I just write off, because when I go to these things, it's so loud. I don't have any quality interactions, especially the post-dinner. Like one dinner, great. Talk to people one-on-one next to me, all of that. But like go to see Third Eye Blind or the Grateful Dead or whatever the thing is, that's nothing of any value to me at all.
I completely agree. I think I don't know if any of us are actually going to go. I'm a vendor, so we are going to have some booths in there. But I already told my company, I'm not going to be in the RSA actual convention. I'm going to be chatting with people outside the convention, right? Yeah, that's right. But Jerry, those bike rides are some of the most phenomenal. You have like one-on-one with people for 1-2 hours, and you have a select group that can, have a real deep conversation.
It's the cyber bike ride, yeah. No, yeah, totally. If you want to be a really good salesperson, just learn how to ride a little stronger.
Only the person
who feels stronger gets to talk.
I think the biggest challenge for if you're as a startup, like I'm still going to speak as a startup. We're all working for startups here and our own startups. It's really hard to find the venues, even if you try 6-7 months earlier. Most of the big players have already taken a lot of the venues, okay? Totally. And or if there's anything remaining, it's crap. It's outside of the ring of people, or like the distance ring from the RSA conference, or super, super expensive. And the idea of going to a bar, being stuck in a bar with a bunch of security people, folks, I guarantee you there's a lot better things to do, okay? than getting security people drunk and talking about their problems. But I think so what I'm trying to say with all this is done is I really do believe in startups. I do believe that a lot of new technologies, new ideas come from startups, not the bigger players. Unfortunately, those small startups don't have the budget or the connections to be able to host things that the big players do.
Yeah.
My co-founder, Gotti, I think he was the first one to, it requires us to be creative, right? And one of the things that he did and started the trend for was to rent out, actually it wasn't even renting out, he just occupied the first booth in the W where people always walk through it, right?
Yeah.
And he just kept ordering food and the people who were serving were happy because he tipped well. But that booth was his, booth in the hotel was his booth and it got tons of traction. People love to just hang out there. Anyway, now you got to reserve. I think that booth is actually reserved for like 10 years out. So you can't get it anymore.
Oh, it's brilliant though.
But it was brilliant. Yeah. It was a clever hack of the system. And we as hackers, it's a challenge, I would say. It's a challenge for us to go and find a new way to hack the system because now we have big conference, you know, big pharma, big conference taking out all the space and not making it easy for us to, the small ones, to do something.
Get a hot dog stand outside the WODRC conference and give away the hot dogs for free for cyber people and just have, right?
Yeah.
I think the city of San Francisco will fine you for that.
But if don't worry about it. It won't fine you. If you make it a dispensary, there's a code loophole where nobody can touch you.
That's right.
Anyway.
Well, good. Well, that's fun, guys. I'm looking forward to seeing both of you out there. We haven't made plans yet, but I'm counting on it. And Mario, you were saying every place is at a premium, so I'm sure you're going to rent out your living room for about $50,000 for an event or something.
Good. We got to ride together, Jerry. We're doing one together when you're
happening.
Here.
And it's going to be a cybery ride, cybery group.
Yeah.
All right. Well, great. Well, guys, it's fun as always. Looking forward to the next time already. And anybody who wants to hit us up with any recommendations or feedback, you know, take a look at the LinkedIn channel. Or get it over to us any way you can. We're always improving. Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks.